Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with a front page article from the Wednesday, April 24th edition, headlined, FEC Filings, Incumbent Dems Have a Cash Edge. This front page article by Ken Dixon. Incumbent congressional Democrats in Connecticut have major cash advantages over their Republican challengers, with only George Logan, a former state senator who narrowly lost to 5th District U.S. Rep. Johanna Hayes in 2022, reporting a competitive war chest as he tries again to unseat the third-term congresswoman in November. Still, according to the latest finance filings with the Federal Election Commission, Hayes had more than $1.4 million on hand at the end of March, nearly twice as much money as Logan, an Aquarian executive who reported about $740,000 on hand for the first quarter. Another Republican hopeful for the nomination, Michelle Botelho of Danbury, reported $7,410. Logan reported nearly $185,000 in contributions from 57 out-of-state political action committees, plus about $684,000 in individual contributions. Hayes, a former National Teacher of the Year who won re-election in 2022 with 127,838 votes to Logan's 125,834, reaped about $525,000 in contributions from more than 200, mostly out-of-state political action committees. She also reported more than $1 million in individual contributions for her campaign to continue representing the state's 41-town Northwestern District. The 2022 contest between Hayes and Logan attracted national interest, including a visit from Vice President Kamala Harris for Hayes, and Republican members of Congress for Logan. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson of Louisiana recently held a fundraising event for Logan. The University of Virginia's Center for Politics has at this point analyzed the race as leaning Democratic. In other congressional races, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy has amassed $9 million in his campaign for a third six-year term, and Republican challenger Gerald Smith, the first selectman of Beacon Falls, reported $26,096.52. Two other Republican hopefuls, Robert Hyde of Simsbury, reported having $28.85, while John J. Flynn of Norwalk reported no cash on hand. U.S. Representative John Larson of the 1st District, seeking a 14th two-year term, reported $328,899 on hand compared to Republican James Griffin's $1,363. Two other hopefuls, conservative Nicholas Simochoko and Republican Mark Hancock, reported having no money. 2nd District Rep. Joe Courtney, whose district encompasses much of the eastern section of the state and was first elected in 2006, had $561,063 in his war chest, while Republican Mike France, a former state representative, reported $102,969. This race will be a rematch of 2022, when Courtney won with 165,946 votes to France's 114,506. 3rd District U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro, who was first elected to the seat in 1990, has $251,683 on hand. Her Republican challengers include Rafael Irizarry of Stratford and Michael Massey of New Haven, neither of whom reported having any cash on hand. Another New Haven Democrat, Lysia Lee, also reported no money on hand, according to the FEC. In the 4th Congressional District of Southwestern Connecticut, U.S. Representative Jim Himes, who was first elected in 2008, reported $2 million on hand for his re-election campaign. His challengers include Republicans Robert McGuffey of Fairfield with $73,426 on hand, Michael Goldstein of Greenwich, who reported $8,760, and Dan Maresi of Norwalk with $42.21 raised. Also challenging Himes is independent Jaden Joseph Skudlarek of Fairfield, who reported no money. On Saturday, May 11th, the Democratic State Convention will be held at the Mohegan Sun Resort and Casino, while Republicans will gather at Central Connecticut State University on Monday, May 13th. Congressional conventions will be held in each of the five individual congressional districts. In a front-page article by Ken Dixon, legislators okay a raise for unionized workers. The General Assembly in Hartford on Tuesday approved a 2.5% increase for 46,000 unionized state employees in the last year of a four-year contract, and also a $1 million bump over 3 years for 150 postdoctoral students at the University of Connecticut Health Center, including 3% more in the first year. "We need workers to get paid correctly," said State Senator Kathy Osten of Sprague, co-chairwoman of the Budget Writing Appropriations Committee, when the $70 million contract for the State Employees Bargaining Agent Coalition, or SEBAC, reached the Senate floor before noon. "There is no reason not to pass this contract," said Austin, a former state correction officer. "We should be honoring the workers that do the things we expect them to do. I think they deserve to get paid. This is an honest contract that services the needs of the employees of the state of Connecticut." Workers in the 35 participating SEBAC bargaining units, including education, healthcare, social services, law enforcement, university professors, prosecutors, judicial staff, and correction officers, will be contracted until June 30, 2025. Much of the funding has already been budgeted. The next contract negotiations with SEBAC would start by the end of this year. The so-called reopener for the fourth year of the deal was negotiated earlier. "It's already fully paid in this year's budget," said Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff of Norwalk. "This is a vote for the middle class." He noted that since 2008, the state workforce has decreased by 14,000 positions. "We've asked our employees to do more with less." Minority Republicans, outnumbered 24-12 in the Senate and 97-54 in the House, complained that many of their constituents are hurting financially and that the state could invest the funding in other services. "I don't think we're shortchanging our state employees in any way," said Eric Berthel of Watertown, a ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee, warning that the deal would also expand the state's pension liability. Berthel, noting the total $2 billion cost of the contract over 4 years, said his constituents, including residents and business owners, are financially hurting and find the high cost of living discouraging. "These contracts are ultimately exempt from these factors in real time," he said. "That does not best serve the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut." "What it comes down to is what we as a state can afford," said Senate Minority Leader Stephen Harding of Brookfield. "Those working and middle-class families are really struggling to make ends meet," said Senator Kevin Kelly of Stratford. The House and Senate voted on separate but identical resolutions for SEBAC and the UConn postdoctoral students. The House voted 106-44, with 9 Republicans joining the Democrats at about 1:50 p.m. for the SEBAC deal, while the Senate voted along strict party lines, 24-12, shortly before 3 p.m. "It's middle-class and working-class people paying this compensation," said Senator Ryan Fazio of Greenwich. "The taxpayers are going above and beyond in this state. If this is fair, I don't know what isn't." In the House, State Representative Tammy Nuccio of Tolland, a ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee, said that over the course of the 4 years, SEBAC workers realized raises of about 18%. State Representative Mike D'Agostino of Hamden, who introduced the House version of the contract, said that 2.5% increases are in line with the previous years. He warned that the workers would likely make more if the contract expired next year and negotiations went to arbitration. "We planned for this," he said. "We budgeted for this. The average salary for a state worker in this state is $75,000. With the benefits, these are good middle-class jobs. They live here, they work here, they pay taxes here, they send their kids to school here." The UConn Health Center resolution passed the Senate 29-6 with one absent. By 1:10 p.m., the House approved the contract in a bipartisan 126-24 vote. About 98% of the cost is linked to research grants through UConn. I think it goes without saying that supporting research work that's going on at our flagship university has a benefit that's kind of a domino effect, said Berthel. In Norwalk, Lockwood Matthews Mansion Museum gets $3 million. This front page article by Colleen Rose Ozanek. The city's Common Council has approved $3 million in the capital budget for Lockwood Matthews Mansion Museum, which has been under construction for mechanical upgrades since June 2023. The project was initially valued at $15 million, according to Patsy Brescia, first vice chairman of the museum's trustee board, though she said costs were always expected to be higher. The project is now valued at about $18 million with combined city and state funding, the first vice chair said. We're a little more than halfway through the project. Construction that started last summer is part of a two-year project that will upgrade heat and electricity systems and bring information technology support like Wi-Fi to the mansion, which will then be able to be open year-round. The renovations will also make the mansion compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Brescia said that the mansion's utility systems are well past their useful lives and limit public use of the site. There's only one floor with heat and electricity, Brescia said, noting that the inefficient heating system that's over 40 years old. It was built during the Civil War. The mansion was built from 1864 to 1868, according to its website. Without modern utilities or an appropriate fire suppression system, the museum could only be open for about 9 months out of the year. Brescia said with HVAC upgrades and everything, we'll be able to be open year-round, said Treasurer Shannon O'Toole Giandurco last year. It'll allow us to do more programs and allow more people in. Our ultimate goal is to get people in here to see what's going on. The renovations will also add HVAC capabilities, which is significant for the museum, that must close on overly hot summer days and remain shuttered most winters without sufficient heating. The basement and second floor upgrades will allow for greater educational opportunities and programming for students with more spaces safe for public use after construction is completed in late 2024 or early 2025, Brescia said. Once the project is completed, the basement's meeting room will be available for lectures and school events, she said. The museum's archives will also be moved to the basement. We're basically adding two floors of the space to the public, she said. She said that while decorative upgrades to the museum, like restoring the bowling lanes in the basement, would be nice in the future, the work being done on the mansion is required to keep it functional. It's all mechanical to protect the building in the future from fire, moisture, and decay, Brescia said. The most recent work done, led by contractor Consigli Construction, has involved reinstalling the mansion's original flooring, which Brescia said was a complicated and very delicate process. They took up one board at a time, inventoried it, and had it put back in the exact same place, she said. While the work is significant and time-consuming, Brescia said the museum is due for the upgrades. It's a statewide treasure. The Victorian-era mansion was built by financier and railroad tycoon Legrand Lockwood from 1864 to 68. It was threatened with demolition in the 1960s, and citizens galvanized to save the mansion and later formed the nonprofit Lockwood Matthews Mansion Museum of Norwalk, Inc. The Lockwood Matthews Mansion Museum will reopen when the work is completed. While the building is closed, it is offering programs at other locations. And for more information, you can visit lockwoodmatthewsmansion.com. Also from today's front page, Norwalk could see parking passes. This article by Catherine Lutke. For years, some residents have asked for residential parking passes to alleviate parking woes on crowded side streets. Now, there is a movement on creating an ordinance. Currently, the ordinance does not allow the parking authority the ability to establish a residential parking zone, Jim Travers, Director of Transportation, Mobility and Parking, said during a meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission on Wednesday. It doesn't grant them the ability to enforce beyond the metered parking zones. The parking authority is looking to work with the ordinance committee to expand the authority to allow residential parking zones. What that would look like is still being determined, Travers said. Once we have the legal ability to do that, we can design how the program would look. But there's just not a legal mechanism in order to do it today, Travers said. The ordinance is too restrictive. We are looking at advancing the parking authority to have the ability to enforce citywide. In looking at best practices for implementing a residential parking system, Travers said doing it street by street is likely what will happen. If a certain number of residents on a street sign off on an application, then the process would begin. Once the application process starts, an investigation would take place to determine the actual need for parking. If the investigation determines a need, then a program would be implemented. Travers said that residents would likely have to register their license plate for the parking authority to check. Travers said these programs are often implemented in areas near businesses. While not a process established by the Planning and Zoning Commission, discussions about parking passes have come up previously, including during the recent citywide zoning rewrite. They were also suggested in the East Norwalk Transit-Oriented Development Plan, said Anna Tabachnik, a Planning and Zoning Commissioner. It was a key recommendation of the East Norwalk TOD plan, and I know I wasn't on zoning then, but one of the main reasons that, as a resident, I supported the East Village, too, was because of the inclusion of a recommendation for a residential parking pass program, Tabachnik said. In New Canaan, Tony nominees and stars take stage for a nonprofit theater company. This front-page article by Molly Hirsch. A new theater nonprofit is looking to bring Broadway to New Canaan. This weekend at the New Canaan Library, the Connecticut Stage Company is performing a concert version of Little Women, starring two-time Tony nominee Kate Baldwin and Broadway actress Kennedy Caughill. Little Women marks the second-ever show of the Connecticut Stage Company, a New Canaan-based nonprofit founded by Kate Simone and Laura Haskins. The company's first staged concert, Into the Woods, sold out in October. Haskins is the executive director of the Studio for Performing Arts in New Canaan and managing director of Shakespeare on the Sound. As an actress, Simone has appeared in shows in musical workshops in Connecticut, New York, and across the country, and teaches voice and musical theater at the Studio. We met there, and it would just always talk about all these shows we wish we could do and we'd want to do, and then cast our friends, all these incredible professional actors, Simone said. Finally, we were just like, let's do this. We have the talent to pull from, and we're in a community that loves the arts. We felt that we could be a great addition to the scene. We've got this incredible group of teachers at the Studio who their students hadn't seen them perform a lot. And so we thought, what a great way to show the community what they've got right here in their backyard, Haskins said. For their second show, Simone and Haskins opted to go with Little Women as a tribute to their literary setting in New Canaan's new library. Because we were working with the library, we thought, let's do a literary work that's been adapted into a musical, Haskins said. This one just really hit for both of us. We grew up reading the book, watching that incredible movie from the 90s, and it just meant a lot to both of us, and we thought it will really resonate with audiences of all ages. Simone said that having Baldwin was a dream come true. An esteemed actress who earned Tony nominations for her roles in Finian's Rainbow and the recent revival of Hello, Dolly! Opposite Bette Midler, David Hyde Pierce, and Galvin Creel. Typically, Marmee gets cast as an older woman, and Kate is not that, she said. She is younger and vivacious and a really powerful storyteller, and I think it will be a really refreshing take on Marmee. So we're truly over the moon to have her come out and do this with us. Caughill also has plenty of Broadway credits to her name, appearing in Paradise Square, Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, and Beautiful, the Carole King musical, starring as the titular songwriter on tour. Both Into the Woods and Little Women also have the added benefit of being strong ensemble shows, with many parts for characters and their performers to take center stage, some coming from in shows running on Broadway, studio staff and alumni, and during Into the Woods, a current student. The concert format also creates a more intimate environment than a traditional performance, the organizers explain. I feel like it was received in a very deep and intimate and personal way from the audience, Simone said. They're up close and personal to these Broadway stars. You don't get that on Broadway. You're never that close to them, so it's definitely a unique experience. Tickets for the concert are free, though there is a suggested donation of $30, which is aimed at making live theater more accessible for those who might not be able to get to New York City or afford a Broadway ticket. We thought, let's see if we can bring Broadway out to your community and make it accessible for everyone, Haskins said. Whether you can afford a ticket or not, you should still be able to come experience the arts. Tickets are available for Little Women for April 27th at 7 p.m. and April 28th at 2 p.m. at www.connecticutstagecompany.org. In Darien, three people were taken into custody Monday in connection with motor vehicle burglaries around town, according to police. Officers responded to a parking lot in the 100 block of Ledge Road around 4:30 p.m. for reports of a man attempting to enter cars. Lieutenant T.J. White said in a news release Tuesday. White said that Andres Camilo Aldana of Queens, New York, was detained and provided officers with a false identity. He added that a nearby SUV reported to have been involved in the incident was stopped. The driver, 43-year-old Andrea Sarmiento, address unknown, also gave officers a fake identity and said that she denied any knowledge of the activity, according to White. Upon searching the black SUV, multiple stolen items were located within the vehicle. Further, officers located stolen proceeds from two earlier motor vehicle burglaries that had occurred at Trader Joe's and Aux Delices. Both Aldana and Sarmiento were taken into custody by officers, White said. White said that officers received information on a third suspect, identified as Manuel Ruiz of Queens, New York, who was determined to have also been involved in the burglaries. Aldana is charged with two counts of third-degree burglary, two counts of second-degree larceny, second-degree conspiracy to commit larceny, and interfering with an officer. Ruiz is charged with third-degree burglary, third-degree conspiracy to commit burglary, possession of burglar tools, and second-degree larceny. Sarmiento is charged with interfering with an officer, falsify license marker plate, operating a motor vehicle without a license, two counts of second-degree burglary, third-degree conspiracy to commit larceny, and operating an unregistered motor vehicle and third-degree larceny. White said that none of the three arrested was able to make bail and were scheduled to appear in court on Tuesday. In Wilton, speeding a driver causes a crash and assaults officers. This article by Matthew Knox. A Trumbull man is facing multiple charges after police say he was speeding and driving the wrong way on Danbury Road, causing a crash, and then assaulted the officers who responded to the scene. Jorge Oliva was arrested and charged with two counts of assaulting a public safety officer and single counts of interfering with police, disobeying a signal of an officer, reckless driving, and littering. According to police, the incident began around 1:30 p.m. on April 15th, when officers spotted Oliva driving recklessly on Danbury Road in the area near Ridgefield Road, at times driving north in the southbound lanes at a high rate of speed and traveling head-on with opposing traffic. He engaged officers in a pursuit that was terminated, police said. During the pursuit, he threw a baseball cap out of his vehicle's window. A few minutes later, after the pursuit was ended, Oliva crashed the Toyota Highlander he was driving into two other vehicles near Olmsted Hill Road. A woman was injured in the crash and was transported to Norwalk Hospital by ambulance. Oliva then punched one of the officers in the nose, who responded to the scene, and kicked another, police said. After a brief struggle ensued, he was swiftly taken into custody with minor injuries. He was also transported to Norwalk Hospital with minor injuries, police said. He was released after posting $50,000 bond and was scheduled to appear in State Superior Court in Stamford on May 4th. Up in Hartford, a filibuster threat ends an effort to ban weapons from state polling places. This article by Ken Dixon. Facing a potentially time-eating Republican filibuster in the state Senate, the Legislative Judiciary Committee on Monday amended a bill on the safety of election workers, deleting a section banning firearms and dangerous weapons from polling places. State Representative Matt Blumenthal of Stanford said that the political reality is that with the midnight May 8th adjournment deadline coming up, time will be of the essence, and current state law banning the open carrying of firearms should already cover most polling locations. We have reached that part of the session, for those who are familiar with the rhythms of this building, where competing priorities must be weighed, said Blumenthal, adding that he was informed by Senate Republicans that a prolonged discussion in the Senate could jeopardize a variety of legislation. So, there is likely to be no added gun safety legislation this year. And in other news, Connecticut gas prices have jumped 21 cents in a week. Gas prices in Connecticut have climbed 21 cents in the past week and may inch up more as the summer driving season approaches, according to AAA. A gallon of self-service regular in the state averaged $3.71 on Tuesday morning, up 21 cents from the week before and 29 cents from a month ago. The highest prices were reported in Windham County, lower Fairfield County, and the greater Bridgeport area, the Travel and Auto Club agency reported. Part of the surge is due to the recent switch from winter blend gasoline, which makes it easier to start your car in cold weather, to the more pricey summer blend, which causes less air pollution. The bottom line is that the summer blend fuel is designed to have lower emissions, but is more costly to produce, said Alan Slatke, Managing Director of Public and Government Affairs for AAA Northeast. Demand, due to spring and summer travel, also tends to boost gas prices, with a 20-cent jump seen last year around this time. On the positive side, global oil prices have gone down in recent days due to developments in the Middle East, where a wider war between Israel and Iran appears to have been averted for now. Regional gas inventories are also up, Slatsky said, which could further help temper surges. We'll see where it goes, because hopefully that will temper the price increases a little bit, Slatsky said. In business news, Express is to close 4 Connecticut stores amid bankruptcy filing. This article by Paul Schott. Fashion retailer Express, Inc. has filed for bankruptcy and is set to close approximately 95 of its Express retail stores, including several establishments in Connecticut. 4 Express locations in Connecticut are set to close. The Express store at the Danbury Fair Mall, the Express Factory Outlet Store at the Shops in Buckland Hills in Manchester, the Express Edit Store at 181 Greenwich Avenue in Greenwich, and the Express Edit Store at 125 Main Street in Westport, according to a list of planned closings that was included in one of the company's bankruptcy filings on Monday. Closing sales are set to begin on Tuesday. The list did not include the Express stores at Connecticut Post Mall in Milford, Trumbull Mall, and West Farms Mall on the Farmington-West Hartford line, or the Express Factory Outlet stores at Clinton Premium Outlets and Tanger Outlets at Foxwoods in Mashantucket, indicating that those stores will stay open, at least for the time being. Express, Inc. is also planning to close all of its Up West stores, but it does not have any Up West establishments in Connecticut. In the past year, the company reduced its store count by approximately 100 stores, leaving it with approximately 580 stores at the time of the bankruptcy filing. Those closings included the shutdown of the Express store at the Stamford Town Center in February 2023. Finally today, in today's life tribute, Adolf Charles Nederland of Norwalk passed peacefully on April 21st. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, April 24th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.